So let me quickly and a little bit more formally introduce our today's speaker, Dora Abrahamsen. He's a professor at the Graduate School of Education at the University of California at Berkeley. He's currently in Israel. He will tell us a little bit more about that. His academic career started with a bachelor in music from the Jerusalem Academy of Music in Performing Arts. And to test one of the functions of our interface, I will ask you a quick question about that. If you click on the vote button, there's a vote tab. Who of you thinks that Dor's instrument has been piano? Could you please vote on this, make a yes or an abstain or a no? So who thinks that it's possible that Dor is playing the piano? So let me check if our system is working, so we might use that a bit later on. Okay, so possible. Let me clear these votes now. Well, okay. So just to show that functionality, no, he actually played or is playing cello. He might also introduce us a little bit more about that. His Master's of Arts he received from Tel Aviv University in Cognitive Science, and his PhD from Northwestern University already in the Learning Sciences. His main research focus is on mathematics, learning and teaching. And when you read the basic text of today, you know that he is offering a quite revolutionary perspective to the learning sciences. So learning is going different ways. That is, I think, the basic message of this text and of a big part of his work. And I would like to invite Dor Abrahamsen now to himself give us an introduction on his journey through the different sciences until he finally arrived, at least with a part of his research in the learning sciences. Dor, the floor is yours. Everyone can ask questions by just raising the hand, join the queue, or also put it in the chat, and Dor will decide him or himself if he would like to answer directly or keep it for later.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the intergalactic webinar on embodied cognition, grounded cognition. Just before I forget, Laurie, you should look into the work of Jean Bamberger. She has a very interesting iPad app called Impromptu, which is based on her old work, Logo Music, which is kind of doing the things that you are interested in. And in any case, if it's not quite the direction you're thinking, it may be useful to be informed by her legacy. She just celebrated 90, and we're very, very proud to have her at Berkeley as our sort of uber mentor. Well, so I've come a bit of a way since I actually began in music, playing the cello and studying cello performance at the Jerusalem Academy of Music, and actually learning mathematics for a while. And at the time, I was trying to decide, will I be a mathematician, a musician? And as you'll see, with time, I've sort of come full circle. And actually, these days, I've sort of come back to music in ways that I'd never have guessed. Originally, when I was studying both cello and math, as a kind of side job, I was working with various institutions in Jerusalem, designing some math. It wasn't apps then, we're talking about quite a while back, so it was various materials and activities and doing enrichment classes in mathematics and science in schools. But then after I finished my diploma in music, I didn't know what I wanted to study because things that interested me, I had no idea that they were actually part of some discipline out there. I was interested in things like related to my own work with the cello, things like what does it mean to learn? What does it mean to be, what is creativity? What is memory? What does it mean to compose new music? What are all of these things? And I thought it was just some sort of weird idea, but then someone told me, no, this is called cognitive science and people actually study this. So I went and did a master's in cognitive psychology. Now, while I was doing that, I was for a living, I was tutoring in mathematics. And one day I read a paper by Rochelle Gelman, about the constructivist rationalist sort of theory. And I thought, oh, that can help me think about my my students who are struggling with fractions, you know, my students outside of academe. But then when I worked with them, I started thinking, huh, thinking about them is helping me understand the theory. So one thing led to another, and I decided to do my master's to focus on mathematics education and specifically on some kind of gadget that I designed for teaching and learning fractions through perceptual intuitions of proportion, where the idea was that an object, if you look at it from near or far, it looks different sizes, even though we might know that it's the same object. We have various perceptual intuitions, so I was working with that. Okay, I can see the chat's coming in. Okay, sorry. Okay, so after that, I thought, well, what now? And I decided to go on and do a PhD in the learning sciences, still thinking about issues of mathematics education. And that's how I found myself at Northwestern University, working with Karen Fusen, and then also with Uri Wilensky and others there. Now, here's a kind of curious story. It's a bit of, I guess, serendipity, because I was working, developing for my dissertation, a methodology for teaching the mathematical concept of proportion using the multiplication table, where the idea was that you can, if you look at the multiplication table, as you go down two columns, say 3 and 7, 6 and 14, you know, 9 and 21, etc., you're actually getting pairs of proportioned numbers, and you can take a pair here and a pair here and sort of pull out these four numbers, and you have just four numbers, say, you know, 3, 7, and what have you, that these four numbers constitute a proportion. So I was working with that, and the serendipity was that at the end of my second year, after I'd collected my dissertation data, my advisor, Karen, announced to me that she's leaving, that she's retiring, and that she's moving from Northwestern over to sunny California. She'd had enough of the wonderful Midwestern winters. And so she moved out, and she wasn't very tech savvy, and I had to share with her my data analysis. So I developed this kind of way of showing data where I would my video and then take a still and sort of plop it into a Word table, and then take the text, you know, the transcription, plop it underneath that, and then look a bit more, and then take another still and plop it back. So it was something, I don't know, most guys here are pretty young, but back in the, when was it, like the 50s or 60s, you could buy magazines that, which took a movie, like some really movie that was out there, but took stills out of it and wrote the transcription below, so you could sort of read a comics book movie. And so that's what I was creating out of my data. So it was tons of work, and I sat in Evanston in the Pete's Cafe for 6, 7, 8 hours a day for months, and doing that stuff, and analyzing, like, you know, 6 weeks of working with fifth grade students, and every classroom moment, just transcribing the whole thing. And then every time I had like a day or a chunk, I would print it out in color and send it over to Karen. Now, why am I telling all of this? It's not a subliminal advertisement for Pete's Coffee, though they're great coffee, but never mind. The point was, one day I asked myself, what is it that I'm actually doing when I create these little clips? And I look at them, and in every single clip, somebody was doing something with their hands. Somebody was pointing, somebody was talking, someone was making some shape. Well, of course, it was sort of still, but then I would be adding little arrows showing directions that they're moving their hands. And it suddenly struck me that what I'm always looking at is these gestures. And I thought, well, that's curious. What is this gesture thing? Why are they moving their hands? And why is it that I chose those moments to put in my, what I call the transcriptions for Karen? And I started thinking about gesture and what it is that why are we moving our hands, and what are the spatial temporal properties of thinking mathematically and working in a classroom, as somebody earlier said, being embedded within a collaborative community that includes all these material resources in which we do, we foster these sort of ritualistic actions with the materials that then somehow become, captured are these semiotic bundles of motions with the hand and various words that somehow are related, in, it seemed, in very deep ways to the very meaning of what a mathematical concept is. So what the heck is a mathematical concept, and what is gesture to do with that? And I was flying back from a conference in Italy, CERM, that's spelled with a C, C. What conference of the European recent mathematics education, and it just so happened I sat on the flight with Dr. Laurie Edwards, and I was chatting about this and that and told her there's this gesture thing, and she said, what do you mean gesture? It's this huge new kind of interest within mathematics education, and you should read MacNeil. I said, Mac who? You should read Kendon. Ken what? So I, all of a sudden, I was initiated into this amazing world of gesture and multimodality, and trying to understand now what, how all of these things, how all of these things are related. And so where I started taking all of this is asking myself, now where is the meaning of mathematics? Now you can see, say, you know, various representations of a fraction. It can be an A over B symbol, or the a diagram of a part of a whole, or it could be like on a ruler, a part, you know, a fraction of this distance unit, or it could be maybe a rate in some sense, or some people write a ratio in that way. And so I was at the beginning toying with the idea of kind of a structuralistic semiotics, where there's no real meaning out there, and it's all like a figment of our rationalization, as if it's just some kind of language game where we actually the real things are just the representations. But that wasn't satisfactory for me, and it just didn't work well with what I was seeing children do and the way they were talking in the classroom, and the kind of meanings that I felt that I have for this idea of proportion. And so I got involved in thinking about this problem of symbol grounding, meaning what is the meaning of these symbols? And I mean, you can think semiotically. Now, the meaning is, where does it go? Where does it stop? Where does the buck stop? What is the meaning of these things? And so through thinking about the symbol problem, the symbol grounding problem, I got to various literature. We speak about the idea of having some kind of intuitive idea or some kind of pre-symbolic notion. And reading philosophers like Heidegger and others, and trying to understand how we can even begin to speak about the idea of knowing something before we know it, or before we're conscious of it. And gradually turning the tables on my initial epistemology, my initial thoughts about how knowledge is structured, and understanding that actually there are ways of reading the work of Jean Piaget that possibly people haven't been doing in deep enough ways, and perhaps this idea of a schema is related in more interesting ways to ideas of phenomenology. And all of this brought me to this paradigm, which was beginning to come out at the time. Well, actually, you know, going back, you can trace it a century back, but it's increasing and entering into the learning sciences, which was to become called as a grounded cognition or embodied cognition. And just quickly, these terms, because it's a new paradigm that's emerging and emerging within different communities of practice, the names are sometimes a bit different, but grounded cognition and embodied cognition, it's the same thing. These are synonyms, and they just use in slightly in different places. Sometimes like, okay, so Larry Barcelu, former president of the Cognitive Science Society, he came to Berkeley, and we were talking to him about this. He said, well, he prefers grounded cognition, and that's how he refers to it, because it feels to him more related to the kind of linguistic strata of philosophy and the cognitive sciences. But and people sometimes in learning science prefer embodied, because it reminds them of other things. And within the HCI community, it's related to the work of Polder Dorish. So these are basically the same thing. It's kind of like what happened with, you know, design. I say design experiment, you say design research, somebody else, you know, I say design-based research. So it's we're talking about the same thing here. So I want to speak to you about something that I call the delusion of progressivism. And let me tell you what I mean by that. Well, when I came into the mathematics education, coming from cognitive science, coming from cognitive psychology, I was under the impression, or at least I didn't even know at the time that I was under the impression, but it just seemed to me that if we have certain intuitions about the world, if we have certain innate or early developed perceptual capacities, ways of perceiving the world that our species evolved over millions of years as part of our adaptation, just like our body adapted to the environment, so our brain adapted, our perceptual system, our sensomotoric system adapted to the environment. Well, what would mathematics be, if anything, if more than just taking those intuitions and kind of articulating them in, within the semiotic register using just, math talk and so on. And so that's kind of how I didn't even know at the time that I'm thinking that way, but I came across an amazing paper. It's not read much, if ever. It feels sometimes like a clandestine paper from 1981 by Donald Schön, Scho with an umlaut N, or sometimes Schoen. Some of you know the work of Donald Schön from, the reflective practitioner, teaching reflective practice, etc. In 1981, he wrote it's called the Working Paper Number 8 from the MIT Media Lab, I believe. And he speaks there about different kinds of intuition. And he says, well, there's this kind of romantic idea of intuition, where there's like the Jean-Jacques Rousseau way of thinking about it. The child has his intuitions. Don't tamper with those intuitions. Don't teach where you don't need to teach. It's this natural thing, and it's a romantic idea. Well, that didn't take you only so far. And then there's the progressivist idea of intuition, which says, well, we begin from intuition and then we progressively kind of articulate it further and further in mathematical ways. And there's a sort of continuity or quasi-continuity where the intuitive ideas become more and more refined and more mathematical and just moving into a different register. And that's, you hear it also in the work of Freudenthal, and in many places it's implicit to the discourse on mathematics education. Well, I came in thinking that way, or at least I learned that that's how I think, but I had a big disillusionment because when I was working with children, I realized that to help them describe in a mathematical way what is their anyway, what is their intuition, you come up against a clash. Because it turns out that the mathematical analysis of everyday phenomena attends to properties and elements of the phenomena which are not part of the intuitive ways of looking. We look at things holistically, we make judgments globally, we see things as gestalt, and we have certain intuitions and we make judgments and we work according to them. But then comes mathematics and looks at things very differently. For instance, I can present two lines. Maybe let's see if this thing works. Does this thing work? Getting weird reflections. Maybe. So I can present two lines and ask you which one is, which one is steeper, and you could probably tell me quickly which one is steeper, unless we have some weird stuff with angles. No, but this, seeing this one is a steeper one. And I think that, I mean, there are no clear answers what, how it is that you do it, but you just know that this one is a steeper one. I think it's got something to do with the sense of how much effort I'd have to do, put in if I had to climb this one as compared to the other. But anyway, you just know that. But then mathematics comes along and says, well, we need to make, put these things into graphs, and we need to measure how high it goes here, and this one, how high it goes here, and how much. The rise and the run, and then take the measured value of this rise and this run, and divide this one by the other, and we get to quotients, and then the one that's bigger, that's the one that's steeper. Well, how progressivist is that? I mean, that's not exactly enabling the child to articulate progressively what they're already seeing. So there's something going on here, and that I gave you just one example, but it keeps recurring. Whenever I try to recruit children's perceptual capacity, I always come up against this clash where the mathematical way that I'm suggesting for them to look at is parsing the world in a different way, so much so that Gene Bamberger and Andy DeSissa call that a case of ontological imperialism, meaning as if we, the teachers, are coming to these children, the natives. We bring you gifts, right? But in so doing, we are imposing on them certain ways of looking at the world that are foreign to them. And then we begin these amazing and questions of why is it that the child accepts our way of looking? Does the child even begin to accept our way of looking? And what has all this, I know some of you are interested in identity, what has all this to do with identity? You might look at the work of Anna Sfard, Sfard, Anna Sfard and her students, such as Einat Haid Mitsunim, who ask, well, what does it mean to accept the hegemonic way of looking at the world? I have my intuitive way, and how can we make these ends meet? And so, going back to the paper by Donald Schoen, so I'm no longer a romanticist, a kind of romantic view of intuition, and I'm no longer looking at it as a progressivist. I'm looking at what he calls a synergist. The question is, how can we both enable students to recruit, how can we elicit and leverage and enable them to draw on their intuitive ways of looking at the world, but at the same time enabling to negotiate those meanings with the, in my case, mathematical, but choose your discipline, science or what have you. How can we enable them to negotiate that with the scientific or mathematical or Vygotsky would just say the naive and the scientific. How can we make these two meet? It is not enough to just to have intuitions because that, civilization has decided to go beyond that and to we need tools that are more sophisticated. But on the other hand, if you only give children, formulas and ways of looking and ways of working, then you're never actually speaking to them, you're never enabling to build personal meaning. So my work is about creating learning environments that in which students have opportunities both to elicit their own intuitive ways of looking at the world and to negotiate the techno-scientific mathematical ways of looking at the same phenomena. And you'll see this in my work over and over. If it's probability with scooping marbles, slope, if it's about proportion, I first enable kids to make correct mathematical judgments, or rather to make correct perceptual judgments about phenomena, and then I suggest to them a mathematical way of looking at the same phenomenon, and then there's this nuanced discursive sort of negotiation around the two ways of looking at the world and trying to come to a place where the child discovers how to accept the techno-scientific view on the world as reconciled with her intuitive way. So when I speak about about discovery-based learning and about reinventing, which is things it goes back to Piaget and Bruno and others. For me, reinventing is not reinventing the concept per se, or the process per se. For me, the idea of discovery and reinventing is for the child to figure out how they can look at the cultural form, how they can look at the cultural structure in a way that is reconciled with their intuitive way of looking at the world. So that's what I think of as discovery. So my work is about the relation between I can say action or and intuition on the one hand and aesthetics on the one hand and on the other hand concepts. Or you might think oh, as Jean Bamberger says on the other hand is the it's the symbols or the semiotic systems. And I work in an approach called design-based research, which all of you, I'm sure, have at least heard of, seeing as you're interested in the in IASLS, where design-based research is very well represented. And design-based research, the basic idea here in a nutshell, at least the way I see it, and again, this is something quite young as a paradigm, and people have different definitions. I do research on mathematical cognition, teaching, and learning, but I do this research within the context of the design practice. Okay, I do research within the context of design practice, and part of this is being very open and articulative about the ways that we think about building design, about the sense we are making of our learners' engagement of our designs, which, you know, when we look at videography of this work. And through that, I'm trying to contribute to developing theoretical models of what it means to teach mathematics, to learn mathematics, and also in a sort of reflexive or recursive way, I'm also attempting to develop principles for designing. So I think that's the mathematical concept of work with mostly have been a proportion and probability. That was like 5 or 6 years during my Spencer postdoctoral award sort of time, and now back to proportion, working with other technologies, and also dabbling a bit with algebra. But in all of this, I use the context of designing, again, as a means for me to think deeply about issues of teaching and learning mathematics. And we might get later in the conversation to speaking about some of these projects. So Frank, that was my very brief introduction, but basically, I have this heuristic where on the first slide you need to say the most important things, the most important take-home messages. And so, Frank, where should we go from now? Shall I start speaking perhaps about the slides, or did you want to say any other words before we go there? So I'm going to press on stop broadcasting and let Frank jump in.
Well, I would say yes. Why not looking into your talk? Thanks for that introduction. That was great. If people have questions at that point, but you would now go on with some systematic introduction, I guess, to your work, and I think that's fine.
Okay, thanks, Frank. So by now you should have the slides, and so the cover slide is, of course, just the title. And if you go to slide number 2, and the numbers are on the bottom right, in slide number 2, you see my the cat. I call it the GoFi cat. When we think about embodied cognition, grounded cognition, etc., so what is it? As many paradigms that are new, a very convenient way of speaking about what they are is by saying what they are not. And again, this is there are many definitions out there about embodiment, etc. Philosophers speak about it in one way, cognitive sciences speak about it in another way, people in cognitive linguistics, people in robotics, people in cognitive psychology, people in all kinds of different kinds of domains have their own specific takes on it. And as always, and kind of reminds me of the Monty Python, those who saw, you know, the United Judean Front versus the Judean United Front, etc. People are speaking the same ideas, but using slightly different definitions at the time. But I'd say that as a whole, what is common to all these approaches is in saying what it is not. And for a long time within the cognitive sciences, the dominant epistemology, sort of what, how do people think, what does it even mean to, what is the mind, was very much influenced by the technology of a computer. And it is known that very often a civilization will interpret themselves using their own technology as their best metaphor out there. And some speak about how Freud spoke about, you know, valves and suppression and all of these and being influenced by the steam engine. Well, in the 20th century, the machine has been the computer, and the way people used to talk about it, or still some do, I guess, or not even aware that they do, they think of the brain as of the mind as some kind of old school robot, right? you have certain sensors, the eyes, the ears, smell, etc., and touch. And these sensors bring in information into the central CPU. And then you have these kind of abstract symbols and abstract proposition churning away, taking account of all this information and processing it, right, in the process central processing unit, and then coming to certain inferences and decisions, and then, okay, they're sort of implementing those decisions out there. And so it was, input, process, output, and then input, process, output. And that kind of made sense. I mean, it seems logical. You take in information, you think about it, and then you work according to it. But that doesn't seem to be holding water. So much so that Barcelou, for instance, says the onus is now on the old school, those who think that there are abstract symbols that are being, or propositions that are being processed in the mind, the onus is on them to show this, because, yeah, this says we've looked everywhere and we haven't found these abstract symbols, but rather they are finding other things. Now, I wanted to go on to, oh yeah, so the cat. So the cat is kind of the GoFi, good old fashioned artificial intelligence, where you see it's I don't know, to those of you who find it funny, I'm kind of curious why you find it funny, but I find it funny because it just seems absurd that a cat needs to make all these calculations instead of sort of doing sort of the looming and jumping ahead. Actually, that word loom, LOOM, that is what, why am I telling this? Like when you see an animal is about to jump, they kind of go forward and again, and then they jump. Apparently, what they're doing is they're trying to figure out the musculature and the sort of the whole scheme that would be necessary in order to traverse the distance, and they're doing that by bringing themselves near and far to calculate. Anyway, why am I telling you all this? So the cat. So we're moving beyond the cat, and if you go to the next slide, I want to talk just about a few kind of empirical findings that I mean you might know them, but these are the kinds of findings that are not so much giving concrete, well, actually the mind is this and this and that. But they're making cracks. They're showing like significant cracks in the good old fashioned artificial intelligence way of thinking. And you should know that this debate is certainly not over. You'll see, like the very first one, I'll say that people talk about verbs, with the reading of verbs as being very much about the body being involved. And so the other people say, well, okay, we'll concede. Well, you can take the verbs, but what about nouns? What about nouns and adjectives? And so then they crunch, 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 and do some other study. Ha! We've conquered the adjectives. Well, we've still got the nouns. What about love? What about justice? And then other person come along. Ah! You see, even justice is embodied. Well, we've still got whatever we have. This word or that word. So. The debates are still occurring, and you'll see lots of special issues within philosophy journals and philosophy of education journals and within the cognitive science. All these debates and trying to say, so where is the mind? Is the mind just in the head? Oh no, it's also out there. Well, how out there is it? Well, we don't want to say the mind is all over the room, because oh wait, the mind. Oh okay, the brain is in the head, but the mind. Oh well, metaphorically, no, I don't mean metaphoric. So these debates are still there. Okay, so let's look at a few of these studies. So the first one that I put there, and I'm not sure if I'll pronounce these names. They look German to me. Hauck, John Schröder, and Pölder Müller. Frank, I probably did a terrible job there. So this is a study in which they were wondering about the role of the of certain brain functionalities within the comprehension of words. And so they let people, this is a event-based fMRI, they put people in an fMRI, and they look to measure regions of the brain that are activated given certain stimuli. And they let them read all kind of words, and three of those words, among the various distractors, with these that you see, lick, pick, and kick. It's a bit like a Dr. Seuss kind of thing. Now, when people read the word lick, it turned out some place in their brain lit up that is the same place in the brain that lights up when you're actually licking, okay? And similarly, when they read the word pick, as in to pick, to lift something up, other areas in the brain lit up, which is exactly the same or very close to the place that would light up when you're actually picking up or lifting an object. And the same with kick, the places where, if you were kicking a ball, I was going to say football, that's soccer. I keep forgetting what country I am, what continent. So if you're kicking some kind of ball, then that place of kick would light up. So they said, well, you see, it seems like there isn't some kind of central meaning-making place in the brain, but rather we can work towards a theoretical model by which actually the meanings of words, they come up through the body first simulating the actions related to those verbs, and only then there are regions of the brain which sort of attend to that aspect or to that action, and that is how the meaning is made. Now, of course, others came and said, well, we don't really know. It could be that it's exactly the old models that we've always had, but when you read, this is kind of epiphenomenal. There's like a byproduct. Well, okay, but there have been many more studies on that. I wanted to give you a sense. And actually, just 2 days ago, I read another study that's supporting even further this idea of the, I think they call it the language action or language motor or reading motor, etc. Links. So you see one crack in the wall. I'm going to go to the next one now. I just find it the weirdest one, and this is a study by Jasmine and Casasanto, and they call it the QWERTY. I call it the sinister from the word sinistra, the left, the sinister QWERTY effect. Now this just blows your mind. You're like, you want to go and say, this cannot be. This is total nonsense. Surely they got something wrong. Well, here's what they did. If you look at your own, you probably all have computers there. If you look down at the keyboard, you'll see, well, some characters are to the left of center and some the Roman characters are to the right of center. Okay? Well, okay. So what's that got to do with anything? So of words to read. And all I said, we're asking you to judge whether these words are positive or negative. Just we ask you to judge. It could be anything like, teaspoon, closet, words that you wouldn't necessarily say, oh, ice cream or pizza, that sure, that's possible. Just any old words. And they had people rate all of these words, and they found an astounding finding. If you take any word, you look at the composition of that word, like underneath here, I see the word stop. I said stop broadcasting. So stop, STOP. So STOP, it's made of two letters from the left of the keyboard and two from the right. So that's kind of, it will be balanced. But if I take a word like, I don't know, milk, which is all on the right side of the keyboard, MILK, well, people would tend to rate that more positively than a word like, I don't know, dew, DEW, which is all in the left. And of course, nobody had any idea of why they're rating it that way. And surely nobody, when they asked people, nobody ever thought of the connection between the letter composition of these words and their placement on this pretty arbitrary thing. I mean, the QWERTY thing. You know why? You know what the QWERTY effect is? Way back, there used to be typewriters with, all these hammers, and these to come, the hammers used to sort of get all stuck together and you had to free them. So some engineers came up with this idea of separating the letters to the left and the right according to their frequency and sequence within language, so as to maximize the differentiation between the hammer strikes, so that you'll have as little as possible to minimize the. So that's how they came up with the QWERTY thing, QWERTY. Now, of course, today that's completely meaningless. There's no actual mechanical thing going on, but we're stuck with that. Even though there are other ways, the Dvořák and other ways, but we're stuck with it. So that's the kind of the classical QWERTY effect, the idea of being stuck with a certain technology for reasons of it just makes no sense to change it financially, commercially, because people already. Anyway, but what Jasmine and Casasanto are showing is that our affect for certain words is mediated tacitly through our encounters with a particular arbitrary technology. Well, that seems to be another crack in the wall. It seems like somehow our body action, through which we have been, especially us, academics, writing so much, through all of this work, somehow implicitly words have received a certain valorization, positive or negative, just according to left and right composition of letters. So this kind of stuff is weird, and you should look at the work of Casasanto because he has more and more and more of these studies showing the relation between body state, body posture, and various mediating technologies and activities that you're being immersed in on the one hand, and the judgments on the other hand that you make about various stimuli. And it just, as I said, it just blows your mind. Another one down there is the next one down there on the slide is what formal symbols as diagrams. So this is work coming out. Wait, I did not respond differently. A question from Don. No, that they didn't have. As far as I remember, it was only according to the keyboard. Oh, I'm looking at the chat. That's why I saw Don's question. So, I'm not talking to someone here in the room that you cannot see. Coming out of Indiana University at Bloomington, the lab of Rob Goldstone, work of this is Dave Landy and other ones over there, G. Son and others. So it turns out, when we look at what's the first one I have here? Yeah. So on the slide, I have this three times four plus five as compared to three times four plus five. Well, you'd think that this is just symbols, and people tend to think of symbols as completely abstract and has nothing to do with concreteness, nothing to do with actions, nothing to do with having a body. It's not, it's just by mistakes, it's in space because we just have to write it somewhere and kind of linear, but it's nothing to do with the concept itself. Well, it turns out that people react much faster to. Let's see, I was just. Okay, Don, we'll get back to that later. So it turns out that people parse or interpret mathematical symbolic propositions much faster when the spacing corresponds to the order of operations. So why should space matter if it's just abstract? But then they did something, I think, really clever, and they gave people algebraic expressions to solve, propositions to solve. Now, in some of them, the next intuitive thing would be, say, to take the x and turn and move it from one side to the other. Okay, and you'd think that this is something completely abstract. We're not really moving it. It's a kind of a little heuristic that we use, the way that we think about it. Maybe we teach that way. But what they did is, in the back, this was on a computer screen, and in the background, they had these sort of waves flowing up and down, very kind of faint, but in the background. Now, the waves could flow either from right to left or from left to right. And the algebraic propositions would be those where you either want to move the symbol from right to left or from left to right. Well, it turned out that when the waves were flowing in the same direction as the direction you wanted to move the symbol, you would do it quicker than if it was going opposite. So once again, how can this be? You'd think, well, if this is, what can be more abstract than mathematics and symbols? Well, it turns out that it does actually matter. So here's another sort of crack in the wall. Even the holy grail of abstractness, mathematical symbols, is not as abstract as some would like it to be. And I have just one more. And this is, as I said, it's just a sample of different kinds of empirical research that I find interesting. The next one I put down there is from Elissa Antle. And what she found was she had people. She showed people various slides, various situations that were somehow related to issues of equity. Okay, you'd see maybe a difference between a homeless person and a person, a sort of rich person. All kind of photographs that were depicting issues of inequality in society. Now, people could cast their judgments. There was some kind of task you needed to rate how relevant these pictures were, something of that sort. But you could cast a judgment either through some kind of manual input or by you'd be standing on some kind of fulcrum, and you would have to lean with your whole body either to the right or to the left. That's how you input your judgment. Now, it turned out later, the judgments were more or less, they were the same across these two groups. However, it turned out that those who used their whole body in order to input their work later rated much higher on a post questionnaire of a sort of social activism awareness and a kind of stated proclivity and attitudes towards doing something substantive about issues of equity. And the way that Alistair and the collaborators, Antle, explained this, she said that what is going on is she used the work of George Lakoff and Mark Johnson. It's a cognitive semantics theory called conceptual metaphor, by which the idea there is that ideas, notions that are, if you might call abstract, such as equity or justice, the very understanding of those ideas are grounded within embodied experiences, embodied senses and posture and somatic consciousness. And so she believes that it is because they activated this sense of balance much stronger in that one group that then they were projecting much stronger on those ideas of abstract ideas of equity. Now, again, you might agree or you might not agree with that interpretation, and I know that for quite a long time now, this work of conceptual metaphor has been pretty dominant within the embodiment theories of mathematics, certainly through the work of Rafael Nunez, collaborating with George Lakoff and Nunez students and so on, but and the work of Gilles Fauconnier and Mark Turner. But there are other voices out there now, such as those who are saying that there's just no such thing as representations in the mind at all, and that this theory fails to treat issues of interaction and of social mediation and of emergence, and doesn't speak to a whole dynamical systems theory approach to learning. So we are seeing, you know, we're seeing a lot of changes. Now, what I wanted to suggest now is a little. I've spoken a lot, and I wanted to suggest a 5 minute little exercise in which within your groups, and you'll see on the slide number 3 at the bottom, it says assignment. What are possible implications of this line of work for educational theory and practice? For instance, you might consider issues of instructional materials, activity, and content. So I wanted you just to invite you to have a huddle there. I know some of you are in groups, and I'm sorry, people like Anna or I think Lori, who are all alone there. Maybe you can chat to each other back channel. I'm not sure. Yeah, there we go. Huddle by yourself. Try to, that's why it's only 5 minutes, especially for those loners out there. Try to think for a moment, what could be the possible implications of this line of work for educational theory and practice? Like, where might this take us, and what kind of new perspectives might this give you on the work you are doing? What kind of implications might this have for the ways that you want to teach? And why don't you send in some chats later? So let's go for that now, and I'll hear from you as you're thinking, and I'll come back in another 5 minutes. So I'm stopping the broadcast now.
Sorry to interrupt the silence. I just created another flash meeting room. I put it into the chat. So if our singles, our individuals want to chat in the small group, you could go there, but make sure to come back to this room then in 4 minutes.
Okay, so I'm also being conscious of the time. I hope that the people who are huddling in the back channel that Frank created, and thanks, Frank, I hope they're returning. Frank, maybe you can jump into that other sort of room and bring them back in here. So I'm also conscious of time. I see we have 25 minutes left, and so at some point Frank might tell me enough of this kind of pontificating and assignments, and he'll sort of open mic to just Q&A. But I'd like to hear some input from people. So why don't we take like 3 or 4 or 5, depending on time, ideas from people who want, if anyone had something they wanted to throw in. And I guess you'd do that by how would that go? By pressing the Q button, right? Or maybe just by interrupting. Frank, can they just interrupt, or I'm trying to figure out. Oh, okay, here, this is how it goes. Okay, so I'm going to press on done. Let's see what happens. I press. Oh, that doesn't work. Okay.
Don, sorry to interrupt. Your sound is not working currently. Maybe you are still in this other meeting that might interfere. If you could log out of that other meeting and come back.
Yeah, what I was thinking was particularly the study by Landy and Goldstone, how certain ways you present information can, I don't know, well, be easier to parse. And as a musician, I can attest to that with like preferring to read certain flats and sharps, reading flats and sharps, like in a chord note, in a chord chart, if I'm reading chords or if I'm reading notes. But and as that relates to design, I'm thinking about if I were to use music as a context to facilitate learning about presenting certain maybe musical certain musical aspects in more than one way, whether it be music notation showing that in different ways, or whether it be through actual sound. So that's my thoughts that came to me with what we just talked about.
Well, here's just a quick rejoinder on that, and I see, by the way, that Professor Jean Bamberger has joined us here. So, in fact, on my screen, Laurie, your picture is very close to Jean, and you guys need to talk because this is exactly what Jean's amazing career has been about. But in a nutshell, I'd say that many notational systems that we use today, whether it's about music, about carpentry, astrophysics, or what have you, they have a history themselves of emerging often as ways of describing various aspects of practice, and they are influenced to a great degree from the material resources and the physical operations that we perform upon them. And there wasn't any sort of intelligent design behind all of this thinking, well, one day we want to show how within musical notation, you can use that to teach kids about proportions. So often there's like a big mess out there, and there's this QWERTY effect of we can't go back because it's a tradition of hundreds of years. But certainly, Laurie, for educational reasons, there's lots of room for this agency in thinking about how to restructure, if to use Wilinsky and Papert's word, to how to restructure a domain so as to make it more conducive for people to pull out and note and people to notice and kind of reify certain relations and objects that they are seeing within there. Okay, over to Mike.
Hi, I guess I'll try this again. So for me, and so with a brief talk with some people in a back channel chat, what we were really thinking about was so a lot of our work is within sort of smart classrooms or distributed learning environments. And so the idea that you could actually place information throughout the room, and so it's physically indexed to the space. It's not an arbitrary in a book, but where you move within the room has a physical connotation to the way that you're semiotically indexing the knowledge, right? So within a certain spot within the space, you're covering certain things. So as a learner, you move into those spaces to actually do that kind of thinking. And within those spaces, there may also be manipulations of the information depending on, if you're moving from a tablet or from an interactive board, or some people in our group talk about like manipulables, like small tangible bits, right? And by indexing those, you're actually embodying the knowledge within a physical space. So it's sort of like what Dor said, the person who's in the window next to you, you guys should connect. Well, as you move through the space, you're actually connecting your thinking and content and ideas to how you're situated within a three-dimensional space.
Certainly these ideas of inhabiting space, which have also been explored by Ricardo Nemirovsky and his students and collaborators, is a very important one. And what you just said, Mike, also reminded me of these ancient mnemonic heuristics of moving through a space and indexing certain objects there with some information that we later extract. And I would just throw out to you, and of course this is by no means any kind of judgment, because I honestly haven't yet had the pleasure of learning about your work, but I would look not only at the particular locations, but at the nature of the action of moving from one place to the other. And as I won't have time to speak today, but you can follow up in my papers and so on. For me, the idea of intuition is not just about perception. It's not only about action. It's always sensomotoric, by almost by definition. And you can look in the later slides. I have all these quotations that you can chew on. So I would create a situation, if I were working according to my embodied design principles, I would create a situation in which the people within your space, and again, this may not make any sense for what you're trying to do, but I create a situation where there's some kind of problem to solve, which is related to the different locations in the room, and then those actions that you produce in an intuitive way in order to solve that maybe a relocation situation, those actions that you perform naturally then get signified in ways that shift the view into going through the lens or through the perspective of the discipline of that semiotic system. And again, this may make no sense for what you're trying to do, but I just wanted a quick repartee. And is there anyone else there? No, I don't see any other people raising their virtual hand. So, no, I don't see. Okay, thanks, Victor. Method of loci. Yeah. So I want to go on, and unless, Frank, if you want to open this up for Q&A, then you better tell us. Okay, I'm clicking on Frank.
I just wanted to mention that Dawn put a question into the chat that maybe you've touched that in part already, but maybe you want to speak to that. And then, well, also the others. I have a quite specific question but I will come with that question a bit later. While reading your paper, I was a bit scared of redesigning curricula from that perspective, but I come back to the.
Okay, so I looked quickly through the log of the chat, and I see that Don spoke about a radical embodied cognition, and that's certainly a way of mapping where the various thinkers are within the embodiment. So there's the old school, which, you know, sort of disembodied. I don't think they call themselves that way, but it's like knowledge is all in the head, and then they are kind of moving out of the head, idea of the extended mind. The idea of from Greeno of a situated cognition, which is actually much more far-reaching than often is taught in graduate schools, because it's actually based on dynamical systems theory. And I don't think many graduate schools are prepared to embrace those ideas of complexity. But then there are those who say, well, actually, there's no representations in the mind at all. That just makes no sense. And those are people like Tony Chemerow and Daniel Hutto. And others so you'll see in later slides, I won't go into that now. I say some people like Barcelou say, well, there are representations, but they're not abstract, they're perceptual. So they are perceptual representations. And then those say, actually, there's no representations at all. So as I say, and so much so that there was a special issue of what was it, Topoi? Maybe Topoi a few years ago, when they said the title of the special issue was Embodiment, One Church or Many? So they're trying to still, many of us trying to figure these things out. And sometimes some say, well, we cannot, it's not even given to empiricism, it's more of an approach. And others says, yes, it is and should be given to empiricism. So again, Frank, unless you want to open the last quarter of an hour for question and answer, I will. So if you do, I mean, you should let me know now, because otherwise I'll speak about, just the next slide, right? So if I'm moving on to,
Well, I just wanted to support that. We could also have a vote, but my impression is that having a little bit more of you talking would be quite highly appreciated by our participants. But maybe you tell us, I mean the participants, if that is not the case. Else, I would invite you to go a little bit ahead with the slides.
okay, so if we go to the next slide, I want to talk about the kind of work that we're doing now. And I see, okay, so the next slide was an assignment for people. Wait, was it? No, sorry. I'm going through my slides. Okay. No, sorry. So this is slide number four, embodied interaction for content. And I wanted to move more towards design, or what I call embodied design. And to differentiate between two groups of the kinds of technology-based designs that I've seen out there. Some of them, I think of them as more for training, when you've already maybe learned a certain idea or a certain kind of procedure, and then you're maybe you want to train more with it. So one of them, I call it a jumping by number, the work of Ulrike Kress and others, ICLS 2010, where so what they did here was they gave children a kind of number size or number magnitude judgment task, where there was some number which was your sort of the source, and then another number flashed over it, and you had to decide, is this number greater or smaller than the number below? And you could input either, but just manually, and that's one condition, or there was another condition where you had to literally jump. It was one of these, like these jump revolution, is that what it's called? One of those things where you actually have to jump to the left or jump to the right to input your information. And they found that kids who were doing that dance rhythm, thank you, Victor, your font of knowledge. The kids who had to do the jumping were much better later in a number size or judgment of the magnitude of numerical symbols as compared to those who input. And again, they think it's something to do with having a greater span of the number line that you place numbers on, and it recruits certain aspects of physicality that the others didn't. And another work I want to point out is by Adalto and Klein. And they have a whole series of apps that they call Motion Math. And in this particular one, you hold a, where's my iPad? I can't see it. Let's say this is it. And you hold it, your iPad, and a kind of a fraction symbol, like, I don't know, 3/5, sort of falls from the top of the screen and descends down, like in Tetris, it's falling. And you need to tilt your app so that it falls down on the number line on the base in the correct place between 0 and 1. So like 3/5 would fall, kind of. Well, I'm getting my left right reversed because of this funny video conferencing. So the 3/5 would fall in the correct place between the 0 and the 1. And so I think of these things as training versus fluencies. The kind of design that I guess my preference, maybe as a learning scientist who's interested in the foundations of knowledge, I'm interested in embodiment-inspired technological designs, where I take the word technology very broadly. It can be just marbles, it could be paper, it can be some kind of Wiimote device. I'm interested in systems in which people learn fundamental ideas. And really, just in a nutshell, I want to tell you about something called, some of you may have read about it in the paper, something we call the mathematical imagery trainer for proportion. And in this case, what we did is we said, let's start from what teachers already know, but are having difficulty using, and then therefore eventually use other ways which are perhaps not as conducive for deep learning. So in the case of proportionality, many teachers start out by saying, if you put 2 teaspoons of, I don't know, of this, well, probably they don't talk about cocktails, right, in fifth grade, 2 teaspoons of I don't know, oil and 3 of vinegar, or that kind of thing. Or if you put 4 and 6, or if you put 6 and 9, it's always going to be the same flavor. You keep on putting 2 of these and 3 of that. Or say you put in 2 cups of yellow paint and 3 cups of blue paint, you're going to get a certain green pigment. Put another 2 and another 3, You have more paint of the same pigment. And so they understand that proportionality is essentially about similarity of perceptual sensation across different magnitudes, different quantities. Something there is that stays the same, even though the quantities are changing. And that is the essence of an equivalence between two ratios, like 2 per 3 is the same as 4 per 6. Something there in their product, in their physical products, remains, gives us the same physical sensation, even though the quantities are different. However, teachers aren't able to have kids challenge that or discover this or in any way try something new, because they just don't have the ways of doing that. So we created a device where it starts out by children having to discover a particular way of moving. And the idea was to enable kids quickly to see the quantitative properties of the situation, which we in advance judged as critical for making sense of the new concept in light of what they already know. So in our device, kids come into a room and they sit in front of a computer screen, such as you are sitting there, and there's just two cursors, and you're moving your hands with a Wiimote or with a just Kinect. You're just moving hands without anything. And when you move your hands, some cursor there's one cursor up here and another cursor up there. And soon enough, you realize that there's some relation between the way you move the hands and the color of the screen. And we tell the kids, make the screen green. Now, initially, there's no mathematics here. They don't even know it's about math. There are no symbols, no numbers, just action. And so they move their hands around. What they don't know is that we've set it up. So we have on the side a console where we've set a certain ratio, say 1 per 2. That means that if one of the hands is exactly twice as high over the base as the other hand, the screen will be green, but otherwise it will be red. So the kids move their hands and suddenly the screen is green. And they say, okay, what now? And you say, well, find another green. Now, invariably, what the kids will do is they say, well, there must be some kind of logic in this madness. Something is going to be consistent. And so they move their hands up, keeping the distance, the vertical distance, the same between the hands. But what happens then is that they violate the ratio and the screen grows red. So over the course of time, over the course of time, they discover a way of moving their hands, which is to move their hands, what we would call proportionately. And or what they say is the higher you go, the bigger the distance is. And what we see here is that they have to depart from their default way of thinking, which was that the distance should stay the same, and discover something new. Now, at this point, what we do is we lay on the screen a kind of grid. We put a grid on the screen, these vertical, horizontal lines, and we ask the kids, what do you think this might do? And this is what I said. This is the point where sort of culture intervenes. Well, of course, the whole thing was set up. It's like a cultural, right, a social interaction. But this is the place where we intervene with our cultural forms, with our ways of parsing the world, and we're literally inviting the children to try and appropriate this new form that we've put there, but keeping on doing what they were doing before. And without our telling them, without our guiding them, without our modeling for them or cueing for them what they should supposed to do, very soon they start saying, oh, this hand has to go one notch, and then this one 2 notches, and then one, and this one 2. And so they discover that it's one over here and two over there. And later we insert the numerals, and they start finding the various multiplicative relations. And again, in a nutshell, because I see we 5 minutes before the formal end of this meeting, what we see in this case is that the children begin by working intuitively within some kind of environment that is completely unrelated to any discipline, in this case mathematics. And yet, through this work, they can discover a new operatory scheme, a new way of moving that satisfies the conditions that are set up or contrived during the using this mediating technology. And only after they had discovered it in kind of in by challenging their own default assumptions about keeping the distances the same, which is often later reproduced in their numerical errors with rational numbers, looking at the additive rather than multiplicative relations. Only after they discover the new way of moving, we let them signify this way of moving by shifting them gradually into mathematics register. but they discover themselves ways of finding utility in these symbolic artifacts that we interpolate into the environment. And they do so because either they want to better explain to us what they are doing with their hands, or they want to evaluate whether what they were doing was correct, or they wish to just to be able to have better control and then prediction over what the actions are. And so this is, for me, coming full circle, this is for me a classical case of syntheticism. I'm maybe getting the wrong word, of synthesis. So it's not the romantic or the progressivist view on intuition, but the synthesis way of looking at natural ways of behaving and cultural ways of that are imposed upon action and perception, and helping the kids negotiate a way of relating between them through discourse in which we enable them to find connections between their more kind of advanced ways of acting and moving and speaking about this environment, but at the same time grounding it in what they initially saw, which is the higher you go, the bigger the distance. So our time is running out, and I'm going to go the second. Don is asking a question quickly. If it builds from students' embodiedness, why were some students better able to identify the rule proportion version? Well, people are different. Context change. Children come in with different kinds of familiarity with the cultural forms that we bring in, and so they have different proclivities, different abilities to utilize those kind of objects. Just as we may or may not know what a hammer is, or a comb, or a ruler. So with just 1.5 minutes to go, maybe I'll send it over back to Frank now. And you'll see in the other slides, I was suggesting to you an interesting activity to do with music that we didn't get to do today, and various quotations that I like about embodiedness, and references of all the people that I mentioned in the slides. So over to Frank.
Well, that more or less calls for another webinar in addition to go on with that interesting topic. But maybe we use 1 or 2 minutes that we left at the beginning for your questions, for the questions of participants. I would have one to more or less bridge until the to warm up with these questions. That I ask all our presenters, that is how you think, Dor, your work and the work on grounded and embodied cognition is specifically important or relevant for the learning sciences. This is one question. And my second question is, what would be your recommendations for PhD students, or, well, yeah, let's say for graduate students and PhD students to include some aspects of this work in their thesis. So what would be your recommendations to include this work, or if they would like to use parts of this work for their own thesis, what would be tips and hints from your side? But maybe also the others, if you have questions or comments, this is the final chance at this day.
Thanks, Frank. So when I was doing my PhD at Northwestern University, and Victor can resonate, they said that the learning sciences are built on three pillars, as they call them, which are cognition and the social context and design, or very often technological design. Well, I see my work as straddling all those three pillars, therefore, by definition, making it a part of the learning sciences, and especially seeing I work within the approach of design-based research, which has become so salient and almost representative of the learning sciences. But I am trying to help democratize these mathematical ideas by taking a different approach on equity, one that I more in the tradition of Andy de Sessa, which is saying, instead of looking at diversity, let's look at what we all have in common. We all have basically the same kind of somatic sensory system. We're all humans in this terrestrial environment. We all have basically the same kind of sensor perceptual systems. Let's work from that and let's be very open as we develop these kind of technologies and try them out with children. Let's be very insistent on asking ourselves whether the theories that we have read and studied, whether or not they are satisfactory for making sense of what we are seeing there. And I think an advantage of design-based research is that we create contexts which are very different and might challenge the types of contexts where traditionally teaching and learning is measured and theorized, which are schools, which are still operating by and large on the tradition that was 100 years ago. And design-based research is studying not what is, it is studying what could be. And so there's this orientation towards defying the existent and looking for alternatives. And I would say to people, ask yourself how they can embrace these ways of thinking. Once again, always be very open as you think about for those of you certainly who are doing design, as you think about content, try to introspect and ask yourself, what does this content mean for me? And where are these meanings? Where within my body do these meanings reside? For those of you who know the work of Eugene Gendlin, I'm speaking of kind of focusing, sort of thinking at the edge, and trying to create situations where other people might experience the same kind of ineffable or pre-symbolic, as Louise Radford called it, these same kind of pre-symbolic notions. Then ask yourself, what are the formal ways of looking at these same phenomena and analyzing them mathematically or scientifically or what have you, and how can we create environments in which children can or learners can negotiate these two ways of looking and understanding. And no matter what it is that you're working with, you must make sure that all the concepts are grounded in sensomotoric experiences. And Victor Lee earlier mentioned a book that he's heroically editing now on the body and technology. And I have a chapter there where I try to articulate these ideas. And so, yeah, so that's in a nutshell. Be visionary when you design and ask yourself, how do you know what it is that you know, and how can you can create experiences for other, create situations or environments in which other people will experience the same things. Now, I'm looking at the questions here down here. Laurie says, how do you see your work fit with certain kinds of technology design model, i.e. multiple representations? Oh, gosh. well, I'd say, Laurie, before we represent anything, I want to be sure that there's something to represent, okay? I'm not at all being facetious. I'm being completely frank, if I may, or earnest, candid here. Very often, we have the illusion that children understand what it is that we are talking about, but actually turns out that they are developing a fluency within the semiotic register of manipulating symbols and being very good at it. I can tell you my own experience. I aced physics in high school, but until today, I don't know what M times V means. What is M times V? All I know to do is move the masses around and half MV squared equals E equals. I know to do that very, very well, but it was all just plugging numbers. I have no idea how to conceptualize the product of mass and speed. I don't know what it is. And if only they just put me in a little cart and move me or make me push mass, I'd know what they're talking about, or shove me up against the wall so I feel the impact. I would know what they're talking about. I never knew what they were talking about, and yet everybody thought I was, you know, I really understood physics. I didn't. Okay, what are other people writing here? Okay, I think that's where I've got. There was a quick question earlier on. Okay, Don said, okay, we touched upon that. Okay, I hope I haven't missed anyone's comment. I'm really sorry if I have, but please go ahead and write to me. And here is my email, and I'll get it. We have internet in Tel Aviv. I'm spending a year in Israel on sabbatical. Okay, there's somebody here who wants to jump in.
Yeah, I just wanted to know, one thing I've noticed, there are some other people, I guess, who look at this, but what do you think about sort of people working collaboratively and using, you know, embodied or physical means as a way of sharing ideas or coming up with sort of mutual understandings on stuff, physically manipulating things in concert or together, or using, you know, collaborative interfaces in tangible or manipulative ways. And do you see anything about that as a bridge? I know, I think Alyssa's done some stuff with that and some others, but I'd be really interested in your thoughts about that.
Thanks, Mike. Yeah, so I think of the word, I go back to Ludwig Wittgenstein's philosophical investigations and the idea of meaning as emerging through the necessity of collaborating. And so, for instance, in this work that we did with Mathematical Imagery Trainer, sometimes we have children work in pairs. So this is, you know, this is Maggie and this is Bob, and they're working together and each one is moving a different object, but they have to coordinate. And so the mathematical language and the object, I'm using an object in the sort of cognitive sense, not necessarily the substantive objects or material object, but things like the distance between the hand, that would be an object for me. So the objects emerge through the vital pragmatic necessity of what's called joint production of an assigned of an assigned task. I see the question from Mike: does a tangible model help them create a shared meaning? Yes, I would say so. I would say because what also happens here is that they can create meanings before they have words for them, before they even know what they themselves are meaning, and it is through what Shegloff calls the sort of the repair. You have to repair a certain discursive situation, but the discursive situation is multimodal. It's not just speech. It's not even just gesture. It's actions. It's kind of like if you and I, Mike, we need to move a sofa out from the living room. Say I'm helping you move, and you know you holding the front, I'm holding the back, and we need to sort of figure out how to do this thing. And we might say, oh, do the thing when you know tilt, rotate, forward, backwards. We have to. A lot of this will be just mediated through haptically, because you'll feel if I'm tugging or pulling, but at times you will have to say, why don't we, and we'll have to invent words, and within our sort of microcosmos or nanocosmos of Mike and Dora moving the sofa, we'll create new little words, which later you and I can even refer to, we even with gestures over a beer, having moved your home, where other people not even know what we are referring to, because now we have shared experiences and meanings that we can look back to. So certainly I think it is very important to have children work together to see how they form this sort of common ground, as Herb Clarke calls it, and how it is sometimes that novices and experts negotiate and create the common ground. There's a paper by Isaacs and Clarke about that. And I am very much interested in something I've never studied, which is just 1 second, Frank, I'll just finish the sentence, which is children's playground games. I don't know, maybe Victor Lee has looked into that. I think it's a fascinating situation because there are all kinds of cultural practices that are typical of a certain age group, even little things with the hands, little patty cakes, little all kinds of games that kids play that adults don't teach the kids. The kids teach the kids, and so it's sort of clean, and you can see how various meanings are constructed through participation, which of course speaks to Piaget and speaks to Vygotsky and others. So over to.
Okay, I think now we really have to close the webinar, although there are several questions and comments remaining. I think it would be great to have another webinar on that topic actually in a couple of months or years. This is a young field, and I thought that this, I think that this was a really stimulating webinar. I thought especially to link everything in what in your teaching to some sensomotoric schemes or skills, that is extremely challenging if you think about well, concepts like logistic regression or design-based research, if you try to advance that with your students. So, well, maybe you have a couple of final comments, Dor, and after that, maybe we just close the webinar. If someone wants to speak, say thank you or bye-bye, that's fine. But I think we should now come to an end. Thank you very much, Dor. Applause. for this entertaining and very interesting, stimulating introduction to this topic.
Thank you very much, Frank, to you and all your crew and International Society of Learning Sciences and this wonderful initiative of Naples. And all. And I know there's a lot of people in the background doing a lot of technical support. Thank you very much. And as I said, this is a young field, and there are hot debates here, and there are schools who are in still in contest, and you know, as you see through the reviews of papers, I'm currently have a paper which I had no chance to speak about, which co-authored with Raúl Sánchez García from Madrid, in which we take a dynamical systems theory approach on learning across sports and music and mathematics. So this is a very exciting time, and I hope that this kind of field grows so that we push the thinking of reviewers of grants, and we get funding for doing this kind of work. And I want to thank each and every one of you for participating this evening, and I'm very open to any communications if you wish to write to me, Skype with me, etc. And good luck to everyone and to the doctoral students completing their work and their, you know, sometimes you need to stop thinking and start writing. So thanks all of you, and shalom, goodbye.